It was described in 2017 on a PBS special as an epidemic. In the United Kingdom, the British government saw this as such a severe problem that they established an entire new ministry within the government to deal with the issue. They called it the Ministry of Loneliness, and the person in charge of that ministry they entitled the Minister of Loneliness. For those of you that are Harry Potter fans, it almost sounds like something from the Harry Potter series, or if you're remembering Monty Python, it sounds like something that would emerge out of Monty Python. The Ministry of Loneliness. And while it sounds a bit strange, it represents both in Great Britain and here in the United States the crisis that it is, an epidemic of loneliness. There are a number of perspectives on what's going on and why it is. Many, though, agree that the other crisis we're very aware of, the opioid crisis in our country, is but a symptom of the deeper issue. And while the opioid crisis is horrible and indeed also an epidemic and a crisis, it is simply representative of the fact that so many people are feeling drawn to some kind of artificial stimulation. It is representative of the fact that many in our society, including many of us in churches, have gaping holes in our soul. We are suffering from a crisis of loneliness. And it's not just psychological and spiritual, it also affects us biologically. There are studies being done now that are saying people who are suffering from long-term loneliness, young and old, for them, the process of feeling lonely is the equivalent of smoking, get this, 15 cigarettes a day. If you are suffering from loneliness, you not only are in a spiritual and emotional crisis, you are experiencing a physical crisis because your body is suffering physically just as it is emotionally and spiritually. As Christians, we must take seriously this epidemic in our society. Recognize and seek to, as the title today says, conquer loneliness in a proactive, redemptive way. Doing so from the two scriptures that we've heard this morning. We begin with the scripture in the third chapter of Luke. All four gospels talk about this fascinating personality. His name is John the Baptist. In the third chapter of Luke, we get a snippet, but we add together the other three gospels, and we hear this guy is very interesting. He is living in some ways in self-imposed exile in what the Bible calls the wilderness. In Bible times and Bible places in the Middle East, the wilderness is not a beautiful forest with lots of trees. In fact, it's the desert where nothing really or very little grows. We know about John the Baptist. All four Gospels agree that his place of ministry and service is this lonely spot in the wilderness. We also know from the four Gospels, as we put them together, that he had a fascinating diet. Some of you have heard of John the Baptist and what he ate. Locusts and honey. Now think about that for just a second. Those of us that have heard that before and grown up on it, I, like you, probably thought, this guy's eating insects and then covering them with honey. In fact, it's interesting, that might work because most people agree that insects have some element of protein. But in fact, he's living in the wilderness, very little grows. Locusts don't go to the desert. Locusts are where plants are. So we have a hint, and anthropologists have and biblical scholars have said that in fact, it's not so much that he's eating insects, as much as these are the fruit of a locust tree or a carob tree. The other little insight we've got is that honey, while they did have bees in Bible times, and they did cultivate honey from bees, that was less an industry than something else that this probably is referring to, and that is dates. It was a big thing in Jesus' day and in Old Testament times to press dates and get the liquid from the dates. It was a sweet substance that was the equivalent of honey. But also they knew, as Bedouins in the desert have known for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, that you can survive crossing the desert with two things. If you have a large camel container or camelback container of water and a big bag full of dates, because it turns out dates have every vitamin and mineral necessary to keep a human alive for an extended period of time. As much as 4 to 6 weeks, we can live on dates and water. So, John the Baptist is living probably on dates, and then the fruit of the carob tree, which they say actually tastes like chocolate. So how's this for a diet? Honey and chocolate. So John is by himself alone in the wilderness, but people are coming to him. They're drawn. There's something about this guy. He's not lonely, though he's all alone. Maybe he's got caffeine from the sugar and the chocolate, but there's something more going on here. The Bible hints at part of what we can learn in thinking about how do we conquer our loneliness? What was it John had figured out that made him such a prominent and radiant personality? Perhaps the first hint comes from the questions that people were asking him. They saw in him something special. They kept saying, could you be Elijah? In the Gospel of John, there are a whole series of questions. Could you be a prophet? Elijah. Could you be, in Luke, the Messiah? And one clue to dealing with loneliness, John apparently had discovered the formula. He realized, he knew deep down in his soul who he was not. You think about one of the contributing factors, probably folks are saying, scholars, psychologists, psychiatrists, pastoral counselors, part of our issue, part of our epidemic of loneliness is so many of us are trying to be something we're not because, well, we go on social media and we see all these people that are smiling and happy with all these pretty colors and lots of things going on in their lives and they seem so content. And we're not. And we want to be like them, but we can't. And of course, a lot of our economy is driven from the fact that we are given images and are told consistently that we don't have enough stuff. And if only we'll get more and be more, then maybe we'll be satisfied. And we don't quite fit the mold. And we can't quite be what people and images are telling us we ought to be. So we think we're not enough and we suffer from loneliness. It's one of the many symptoms, but John knew who he was not. There's something liberating when you can say, I'm not that. I don't need to be that. I don't need to fit into that mold or that group of people. I don't need that to be me and what God has called me to be. It is a beautiful thing to discover what we are not. But the other thing John discovered, the other part of this formula, is he discovered who he was. To know who you are and know what he is. And this is the key. For John, at least, when he found out what he wasn't the Messiah, he wasn't Elijah, he discovered who he was. His role was to call people to Jesus, to prepare the way, to point people beyond him. In other words, who he is it's not about me, it's about Jesus. What an incredible insight. It's liberating to discover who we're not, and it's beautiful to recognize who we are, that our lives are to be lived helping other people see Jesus, pointing other people to the sacred in the world and in our lives. John the Baptist stands as our first lesson from the New Testament. The Old Testament in Isaiah 43 that was read just a moment ago when Ray lifted us up through these powerful and poetic words in the Old Testament. Isaiah 43 is, while poetic, lovely, reassuring, it also emerges out of an incredibly traumatic time in the history of our spiritual ancestors. It was what was known as the Babylonian exile, or sometimes called the Babylonian captivity. It is people in exile, and in this period of time, this clear historical period from 597 to 539 BC, this window of time is quite amazing in the history of the Bible and the history of our spiritual ancestors. King Nebuchadnezzar, king of the Babylonian Empire, this huge empire that encompassed all of Mesopotamia, even down into the little sea bridge where Judah was located, on into Egypt at one point even. This whole Babylonian Empire encompassed all of what was called the Fertile Crescent. And little Judah had succumbed to the power of the Babylonian armies. Nebuchadnezzar had invaded Jerusalem, had completely destroyed the city, had torn down the temple, and as a part of the strategy that was used in those days, took the key leaders, people like you and me, people who could read and write and had influential jobs in society, and all, in other words, the professional people who helped to run things and who had a voice in how the world, or at least Judah, was run, those people were taken away into exile. They were pulled from the land and the other people, leaving this group of primarily farmers who were just simply supposed to farm the land and help feed the broader empire, while the leaders of Judean society are taken to Babylon under the thumb of Nebuchadnezzar. So it's during this time from 597 to 539 BC where this huge group of folks from Judah find themselves stuck. Imagine not only the trauma, but the following loneliness. They don't speak the language. They don't understand the culture. They're in this place far from home. You can see the map on the screen where they were forced to walk this entire way north through what's today modern-day Syria and then down the Tigris and Euphrates rivers into what is now modern-day Iraq and Iran. And so it is in Babylon where these people are suffering, and struggling, and trying to figure out how to survive. So they're people in exile, and they're people struggling with loneliness. So let's talk for a moment about what goes on in the psyche of people that are struggling with, in many cases, what would amount to probably PTSD syndromes. So we look at this response now. People in exile and people now struggling with loneliness. How do they feel? Walter Brueggemann was one of my favorite professors at Columbia Seminary, just right down the street. Some of you have heard his name before, maybe read his books. And he's got a beautiful book by the name of Cadences of Home, where he deals with this time in the people of Judah and this moment in the development of the Bible and in our spiritual history. Brueggemann calls this time in the Babylonian exile a theological emergency. It's an emergency because the people who are in Babylon are looking around thinking, we've got nothing left. Everything we have ever known has been destroyed. We've got absolutely nothing. In fact, not only are we lonely, but the faith that we had built our lives around seems like it is completely crumbled. It is then a societal crisis because everything they knew had been destroyed. They had been removed from their land, and now they had this sociological disaster where they are completely at wit's end as to how to survive. That was part of the strategy that kings like Nebuchadnezzar used, to strip people of their complete identity and their faith story. So it is in this moment that the people of Judah have a choice. And it is in this moment, we cannot overemphasize the power of this time, the faith that makes us who we are today in this moment of history was hanging by a thread. The people in exile were saying, well, the Babylonians clearly were stronger than us. They had a better army. They must have had a stronger god. The Babylonian god's name was Marduk. And there were people among the Judean people saying, well, Marduk must have beaten Yahweh. Therefore, if you can't beat them, join them. Let's give up what we've stood for. Let's throw away our faith in Yahweh because clearly Marduk is better. So it was a theological emergency, a faith crisis, a social, societal crisis, and a sociological disaster. And the people now are left with basically three choices. The first choice they have in this moment of history is to resist. In conquering loneliness, you can make a choice to pretend that you're not lonely. And lots of us do that. We just go merrily along and we come to church and we smile and people say, how are you? And you say, fine, when in fact you're aching on the inside. But we're at church and we're supposed to be happy, we think. We can't tell the truth about how we're feeling, so we pretend. And we resist the truth, the reality that's spinning around. This is what folks in exile had the choice to do. They could just pretend everything was fine and just go right along. The problem is, it's extraordinarily unhealthy. It does no one any good. In fact, it makes things worse. It deepens the loneliness until depression explodes in heart, mind, and spirit. The other choice was to simply reminisce, to just sit around with a bunch of friends and drink tea and talk about the good old days and remember how things used to be and how beautiful it was back in Jerusalem and how lovely the temple was and how much fun they had and those great dinner parties that they enjoyed together and just reminisce. The problem with reminiscing, though temporarily good, is it makes no difference. It's a very, very temporary fix to the way we think and feel, and ultimately, like to resist, it does nothing to the reality that surrounds us. What the people in exile gradually began to discover was this third choice: the importance of remembering. To remember is different to reminisce. To reminisce is just talk about the good old days. To remember is a deep and abiding understanding of what our identity is, where we come from. Brueggemann reminds us in Cadences of Home that what went on in this exile, this theological emergency and sociological crisis, what was going on was that these people ripped from their homes, dropped in a new land, they realized they needed to start becoming a part of the society that surrounded them. They needed to participate in the economy. They needed to learn a new language. The language of empire in that time and place was Aramaic. They came from Jerusalem speaking Hebrew. They realized Hebrew did them no good in Babylon. They had to learn the language of empire. They had to learn the language of commerce. And they began to adapt themselves. But as Brueggemann says, they never forgot their mother tongue. They remembered. They remembered where they came from. They remembered what made them who they were. That's Randall's gift to us, by the way. Part of the strategy they discovered was to remember who they were. Part of our strategy in coping with our loneliness is to remember who we are. What went on in this fascinating, traumatic time in exile was not only keeping track of their history, remembering their language, there was also this incredible compilation of history and prophetic writing, so that in exile, surprisingly, instead of giving up faith, the faith actually deepened, and roughly two-thirds of our Old Testament today comes from exile. Proverbs, Psalms, the Torah was compiled and edited. The prophets were spoken and written down. Two-thirds of our Old Testament emerges and is edited and compiled during this traumatic period of history. It's so that they can not only remember who they are, but celebrate whose they are. So the other aspect of conquering our loneliness is the value of remembering the depth and breadth of the faith that we represent. For the people in exile, this was redemptive, life-giving, life-saving, culture-saving. It was also fascinating that during this exile period, the Babylonian captors of these people, they were from Judah. They were known as Judean. That was a little longer than the Babylonian captors wanted to mess with. And so they began to call them a derogatory name, a shortened version of Judean, or people from Judah. Does anybody know what they started being known as in this period? Jew. It was a shortened version, a derogatory term, and the people in exile began to say, you know what? That's who we are. We are Jewish. We're from Judea. We will gladly claim that title. We know who we are. More importantly, we know whose we are, and therefore, we know where we're headed. Conquering loneliness, like with John the Baptist, to be able to know who we're not, but know who we are, know whose we are, know where God is taking us. And merging with our scripture from last week, Isaiah 60, this powerful continuation of the people in exile, Isaiah speaking to these folks struggling with identity, reminding them that I am with you, says God, fear not. I am with you always. And then Isaiah 60, now rise, shine, for your light has come and the glory of the Lord is upon you. And you can point others to Jesus and live out the life God has called us to, because we know who we are. And even better, we can celebrate whose we are. Brothers and sisters, thanks be to God. Amen.